Welcome to our weekend workshop with visiting teacher Don Hendrick. My name is Donna Cease. I'm Spiritual Programs Coordinator for Kadampa Center. I want to tell you a little bit about Don, and then I have a few announcements to make. Don is a longtime experienced student of the Dharma. He teaches, he's a resident teacher at Tubten Norbu Ling in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He also teaches at a center in Taos, and he works for the Liberation Prison Project with FPMT, our mother organization. He attended a 7-year Masters of Buddhist Studies program at Lama Tsongkhapa Institute in Tuscany, Italy, and completed the entire course. And he was invited to lead a course that's very famous within FPMT, the November course, that takes place for a month in November of every year at Kopan Monastery just outside Kathmandu. And so he led that retreat a couple of years ago in 2015. So I met Don through the Light of the Path retreat where he was leading discussion groups. He's very articulate, very warm, makes the Dharma very present for us. So I hope you'll enjoy him. Just a couple of notes about protocol. When the teacher enters the room, we stand out of respect for him. And then those of you who come regularly, you know that Geshe-la asks us to go ahead and prostrate with him when he does 3 prostrations to the altar. Prostrations are not mandatory, so if that's something you're not comfortable with, you can just remain standing. When we have a visiting teacher, it's the usual protocol with prostrations is to wait until the teacher is seated. A lot of times visiting teachers will ask us to go ahead and prostrate with them, so we'll kind of wait and play it by ear with Don. If he doesn't invite us to join him, then we'll wait until he's seated to prostrate. So he's doing a workshop this weekend on 8 Steps to a Happy Life. So he'll be teaching tonight from 10 to 4 tomorrow. And then Sunday in the morning, he'll teach our usual Sunday Dharma course. And then 1:30 to 4 in the afternoon, he'll complete the workshop. And we have a lunch break in the middle of that. We encourage people to stay here for that break so we can all get together and talk about what we've been learning. And Don is going to be staying with us, so it'll be a chance to chat with him, too. So bring your lunch and be ready for that. He'll also be teaching Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings. On Monday, he'll be teaching the Discovering Buddhism class on refuge. Tuesday is, what's so bad about complaining? And Wednesday is using work as a spiritual path. So those are both pretty rich-sounding topics. So I hope that you can come to many of those. As with everything, with every Dharma teaching that we offer at Kadampa Center, we offer them free of charge. Nobody asks you for a ticket at the door. But, of course, we do have expenses in bringing teachers and even having our teachers who are normally here. So if you are moved by anything that you hear tonight and really feel it from your heart, we would welcome any donations to help with the cost of having a teacher of the caliber of Don Hendrick here. A couple of fun things coming up. We have our 25th anniversary gala next Saturday. Okay. That's the door where we go. See you. And Jill has been working very hard for quite a long time to make this a wonderful night. Is he here now? Okay. And I'll leave the other fun things for later.
All right. Let's see. So I forget, am I supposed to lead prayers? I'm fine with doing that as well. It's up to you, Donna. So, again, welcome. I'm very happy to be here. It's my first visit to Kadampa Center. I know some of you from the Light of the Path retreats, Looking forward to this year's very much. So anyway, it's great to be here. So thank you for inviting me. So you normally start with... I didn't write it down, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay, so page 27. And English is fine? Yes? Okay. Reverently I prostrate. With my body, speech, and mind, I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Tibetan for this one? Or? Okay. O saji po ki juk shing me to tra Refuge in Bodhicitta. I think the one before teaching is probably on page 98. Yes, page 98. Let's do this once in English and then twice in Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la jang tu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chanyan gipe sonam gi drola penchir sangye drupar shog Sangye chodang soki choknam la Jang tu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chanyan gipe sonam gi drola penchir sangye drupar sho. Okay, let's go ahead and start this evening with a short meditation before I begin the teaching. So let's just find a good meditation posture. Again, make sure that the back is straight. So right, nice uprightness to the body, and also making sure that the mind is sort of uplifted. But also making sure that the body is relaxed so that you don't have any tension that might block your meditation. So just settle into this posture. And whenever you're ready, you can begin to pay attention to the breath. So there are a variety of ways to work with the breath. I'm sure many of you have your own techniques that you use, but I'll suggest one in case you don't have one that you use, and that's working with the sensation at the tip of the nose. Just tuning in to that very subtle sensation that occurs just inside the nostrils as you breathe in, as you breathe out. And the instruction is simple, just to stay present with that as best as you can. But then certainly when you see that the mind has wandered from the breath, maybe gotten caught up in various thoughts, planning, remembering, what have you. You can even get distracted by sounds or other sensations in the body. When we see that that's happened, there's no need for any judgment or anything. We just simply acknowledge that, let it go, and bring the mind back to the breath. So I'll ring the chime, and then we'll do this for a few minutes in silence, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set motivation for tonight. Now let's turn our awareness towards generating the best motivation for being here. And as most of you know this, motivation, developing this strong intention, is an important part of our path. We're going to be exploring this over this course. And why it's so important is because everything really starts with our minds. This is the Buddha's expertise, is the mind, how it functions. So when we set our motivation, we can start with that very fundamental idea that the Buddha says all beings are driven by ourselves and each and every sentient being, simply wanting to be happy, wanting to not suffer. This course we're calling 8 Steps to a Happy Life. And we can be here with that very basic idea of each of us wanting to have a happy life, wanting to help others to have a happy life. But maybe we need to advance on that concept a little more for setting our motivation. Because the Buddha taught that the way to achieving the greatest happiness is by actually being focused on the welfare of all, actually being focused on the happiness of others, so that by being dedicated to helping them on their path, helping them to achieve what they seek, we will actually be in the best position to accomplish that for ourselves. As many of you know, this is what His Holiness calls being wisely selfish. It's very hard for us to completely separate from our own welfare. So as long as we're here with some intention of benefiting ourselves, let's do this with that overriding motivation of benefiting all beings. Think that you're here to explore this topic of these 8 steps that lead to a happy life so that you yourself can have that, but moreover, so that all beings can know true happiness, true peace, can find the satisfaction, the contentment, the freedom from suffering that they seek. I think that it's for this reason that you're going to engage in this course and explore this topic. Okay, I realize that there's a number of people here, but I'd like to have some form of an introduction, especially since I'll probably be seeing most of you for the next few days, and I thought it might be a good opportunity just to get names and that. So I'll introduce myself first, those of you who don't know me. Again, my name is Don Handrick. My Dharma path started about 20 years ago, a little over that, in San Francisco, when I began studying with Sogyal Rinpoche's organization, after reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying in 1993. And I met the FPMT through the incredible kindness of Venerable Rabina, who most of you know. She kind of roped me in and didn't let me go. So that was back in 1996 in San Francisco at our center there, Seichan Ling. And then I started studying in the master's program in 98 over at our center in Italy, completed the master's program, and then went to New Mexico, where I've been resident teacher at Tupten Norbu Ling there since 2006 is when I became resident teacher. And then just in the past year or so, I've been out on the road for roughly half of the year, and that's because we have a resident Geshe now for half the year. So Geshe Tupten Cherub is our Geshe. And so while he's there, I'm away, and then when I come back when he leaves. So anyway, that's the reason why I'm here, doing a little bit more touring teaching, started last year. So anyway, we could just go around the room, and maybe not that long of an introduction. I just wanted to make sure people knew kind of who I was, but if you could maybe say your name, and then just maybe one sentence or so about your Buddhist background, whether you're brand new, whether you've been studying for, you know, however many years. And if you have any particular expectations about this course, if you could do that, let me know that. That would be really useful. So I guess Jill's got the microphone, so we can start wherever it's comfortable for people to do that. And I hope you don't mind. I'm going to take notes just so I can remember most people's names. Everyone thinks I'm really good with names, but that's because I actually do work to remember people's names. It doesn't come that naturally. So.
Hello, everybody. My name is Andres Teles. I am from Colombia, South America. I have been here in the U.S. for 5 years, studying at NC State.
Okay.
And my first contact with Buddhism was 3 years ago when they brought the relics.
Wonderful.
And coming to this space was very meaningful for me. So I started to get interested in Buddhism, and I'm just starting my path,
okay,
I guess. I just completed my dissertation and my PhD, and I study empathy and how especially design students, because my background is in design and education, how design students develop empathy for the people they design for.
Okay, good.
And I see a lot of connections between what I have done and what I'm learning now from Buddhist perspective.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andre Salas.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
My name is Kim Lillig. I've been around the Kadampa Center, I guess, for a decade or so. I don't know. Found a home here in Buddhism, and I'm a retired clinical social worker, so I think the psychological aspect of the Buddha teachings was attractive to me for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I must have been busy in past lives to have the opportunity to be here and to receive teachings and to help in any way I can. So,
great.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hi, my name's Hetty, and I found the Kadampa Center in 2006 when my daughter was in a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a religious all my life until I found the Kadampa Center, and I sort of resonated with it, and I've been coming here since then.
Great, great. Thanks, Hetty.
I'm Jennifer. I'm new. I've been watching the streaming videos online. I figured I may as well just get out of the house and come down and see what it's like to sit in here.
Okay.
So just kind of testing the waters, but it's
wonderful
to have you here.
Good. Welcome, Jennifer.
Barry Judge. I've been coming to the Kadampa Center since 2015.
And it was Eric?
Barry. Barry.
Barry, I'm sorry. Thanks, Barry. Okay, good.
Hi, I'm Arlene, and I've also been coming here for about 2 years now.
Okay.
Fell into this place and don't ever intend to leave.
Uh-huh.
And I'm here to learn a lot more about having a happy life.
Wonderful.
Simple.
And I'm sorry, your name again? Arlene. Okay. Thank you, Arlene.
Robbie Watkins. I've been studying Tibetan Buddhism since 1980. I went to the November course in 1981, and I've been a member of Kadampa Center since 1993.
Yeah. It's so good to see you again, Robbie. Thank you for all your hard work here, keeping everything going. Yeah.
My name is Elizabeth. I'm originally from Poland. I have lived in the U.S. for 20 years now. I live in Oklahoma City. My teacher is Kandra Rinpoche, and she told me to move here to Riley. So I came here to see the center, because it is supposed to be my center. I've been practicing Buddhism for many years, but it doesn't mean I'm such a great practitioner. I have been Rinpoche's student since 1994, I think.
Okay.
And I took refuge in Tibetan Buddhism in 1990.
Great. Thanks, Elizabeth.
My name's Chris. I learned about Buddhism from Robert Aitken's book, Taking the Path of Zen. And I've been coming here off and on since 1999.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Actually, a woman came in late, maybe?
Hi, I'm Lee Carr. I've been coming to Kadampa Center since 2005 or 2006.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks, Lee.
Hi, my name is Rushad. I'm here for the first time, and I'm neighbors with Peter, who's probably been coming here much more than several of us here. I just finished reading a book, The Book of Joy, I think, which is a book written by the Dalai Lama and I think Bishop, or rather Archbishop Desmond Tutu. So I found that pretty inspiring. And I think what you initially mentioned in the introduction was the gist of that book, actually. We're looking to create happiness for others. You make yourself happy. So, and I think a lot of the philosophy of Buddhism resonates with me, which is why I'm here.
Wonderful. Thanks. Welcome, Rashad.
Peter Murphy, neighbor to Rashad. I've been coming here since 2004 with a few gaps in there.
Great. Thanks, Peter.
Renee LaRoe, I've been coming here about 2 years and meditating for many years.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Candace, and I've been coming here with my husband for about 3 weeks. So we moved from the Greensboro area on May 1st, so I've wanted to come here for like a couple of years, and we finally just, it worked out. We were able to move here, and so far we love it, and I'm just here to learn. And
great. Great. Thank you, Candace.
Hi, my name's Stephen, and she did the introduction, so I don't need to add much more to that.
Great.
Thanks, I'm Stephen. Susan. I took my first meditation class here in 1994, and I just got through listening to the Book of Joy on audio, and it's very helpful, very good.
Hey, I'm Jill Marie. Marie's the last name. So I've been studying since 08, and met the teachings in a weird way, starting with all of the entire Lam Rim for 6 days with His Holiness, and I didn't even know what the word bodhicitta meant. I had no idea what anything meant, so came back and thought I better check out something, so I found this place. Yeah. And then I read A Simple Path, because I had to take it down a notch, about 25 minutes. So I've been coming here ever since I wait.
Great. Good to see you, Jill.
Hi, I'm Ernie Alessandro. I've been coming to the center since 2008. I had the good fortune back around 2008 to hear a introductory talk by Venerable Tendrin. Mm-hmm. At a Unity Church downtown, and it kind of spurred my interest. But it's something I'd been interested in since reading Siddhartha back in my early 20s, so it was always kind of cooking there.
Terrific. Thanks, Ernie.
Hey there, my name's Amy Sherman, and I've been coming here for about 2 years, but very on and off, and I also just listened to the, about a year ago, I guess, listened to the Joy. Forget the name. Yes, that one. Well, I'm done, but...
Thanks, Amy.
Hi, I'm Diane, and I came to the center to learn more about Buddhism, and I was with a lay mindfulness group, and they said, go to Kadampa Center. They have Buddhism in a nutshell. They have the meditation courses, and I've just finished 1 year of discovering Buddhism.
Wonderful.
And just find my heart full and really appreciate the kindness and thoughtfulness of the practice of the people who are here.
Wonderful. That's Diane? Yes. Yes. Thank you, Diane.
I'm Scott. Been coming to Kadampa Center for about 8 years.
Okay.
One of my older sons was interested in meditation back then, and so I came with him for the first time, and then that led the whole family here eventually. So it's been really good for us. I just keep coming around hoping some of it will stick.
I'm sure some has, Scott. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Susie. I've been coming here since about 2010, attending class a lot, and again, wanting it to stick, and this makes a lot of sense to me. So
wonderful.
I'm still here.
Great. Thanks, Susie.
Thanks, Susie. My friend. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Brian. I started coming here about 5 years ago.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Brian.
Hi, I'm Peter. I moved back to North Carolina in 1993. And there was an ad in the paper about a living Tibetan master. So I came to the Kadampa Center, and it was Lama Zopa, who was talking about transforming problems into happiness.
Wow.
So I've been a member here for almost 20 years now.
Wonderful, Peter. Yeah, it's great that you all are celebrating your 25th anniversary or commemoration. Yeah.
I'm Tim.
I started looking into meditation early last year, and of course online one thing led to another, and I started looking into Buddhism. Found out there was a center here and came with a friend a few times, and it just lit a fire inside me. I love everything okay. about it so far.
Okay.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure, Tim. Thank you. Yeah, Tim was working on the prayer wheels outside when we stopped by last night. Yeah, thank you for doing that.
Hi, my name is Naga. I'm from Durham. I have been coming from last year, I think, for the Buddhism Nutshell. And then I started taking this class, and I studied other Buddhism divisions mm-hmm. from Theravada and other Zen Dravid from other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see what this class is about because
okay.
I haven't been happy with the current political
okay.
movements. I needed to escape.
Thanks, Naga. Yeah.
I'm Denise Flora, and in 2003, my sister said, do you want to go check out all the different Buddhist places around the triangle? And she laid out this whole map. And so the first place, I said, sure, because I'd been seeking by myself without my husband's participation for decades. And so I was so excited to have somebody to go with me, so I was like, yeah, let's go. And the first place we came was here on a day when Venerable Rubino was teaching. And we never got any further on the list.
Yeah.
She became a nun, and I started doing the essential education, universal education.
Yeah. Amazing. Baptism by fire.
I'm Donna. It actually took me a couple of years to find Kadampa Sandra when we were in the old building. And I started coming in 1999, and I've been here ever since and worn a lot of hats, and currently I have the honor of serving our teachers and students as spiritual program coordinator.
Wonderful. Thank you, Donna, and thanks again, Denise. Terrific. So it's quite a wide array of experience in the room. So again, let me tell you a little bit about what I'm hoping to do with this course, and we'll actually start going into the material tonight. This is one way of presenting the Buddhist path. Many of you, when you were talking, mentioned discovering Buddhism and the Lam Rim, the stages of the path. This is another way of sort of setting out everything that is practiced. In some regard, this is more of a teaching that is used in those traditions that use the Pali canon of the Buddha's teaching, so what's called the Theravadan tradition. But it's nonetheless still something that also very much mirrors a lot of what we do in this Mahayana tradition, Tibetan Buddhism. So what I'm going to be doing with the course is kind of going through these eight steps or eight aspects of the path, and talking about them from both the more traditional ways that they're presented in those Theravadan traditions, as well as looking at how do they apply within Tibetan Buddhism. What is it that we can kind of see as mirroring them, and how would we enhance our understanding of the Tibetan Buddhist path by using these concepts? But they're really a very fundamental way of looking at everything that is entailed in the Buddha's teachings. In a course that is in the basic program for the FPMT, I don't know if you've done the course here on Chapter 4 of the Ornament, Abhisamayalamkara. Have you done that here? Has that happened in the basic program? Are you doing basic program here? Yeah. Okay. In that course, there's actually the very first topic goes through a variety, kind of an encyclopedia of different Buddhist realizations, and one of them includes what's called the 37 Harmonies with Enlightenment. Is anyone familiar with that term? It basically consists of several groupings of things, and one of those groups is the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path does play a very prominent role in the Buddha's teachings in terms of one way to present how we go about changing our minds and working with developing our qualities, becoming free from our suffering, attaining real happiness. So I think most of you have a copy of the handouts that, are there any people who need a copy of that yet? Naga needs one here. There's some in the back there. By the way, did everybody get a chance to introduce themselves? I wasn't sure if any other folks came in when we were... Everyone's fine? Okay. I'll wait for everyone to get a copy of that. Okay. So the very first sheet, we'll be referring back to this one occasionally. This is sort of a summary sheet that gives the full perspective on what these eight aspects are. And I found online a nice colored Dharma wheel. This is the Dharma wheel or Dharma chakra that some of you might be familiar with. It's got eight spokes, and those eight spokes representing the Eightfold Path. So this is one of the ways that this is set out. And they're color-coded there. I tried to do similar highlighting in terms of the color coding so that it would sort of line up. And first of all, we can say that this Noble Eightfold Path can be condensed into the three higher trainings, which is a subject that many of you have heard of. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we do talk about the three higher trainings. That's sort of one way of approaching all of the aspects that are within this Eightfold Path. So three higher trainings, what do we mean by those? We mean that essentially, when you kind of boil down all of what the Buddha taught, you could say that it's to achieve one of three things, sort of three disciplines, if you will. The very first one being morality. I mean, all spiritual traditions teach to some degree, some level of morality. The idea being that there are ways that we can agree in our world, for that matter, in a secular context, but even agree within particular spiritual traditions that are useful and helpful in terms of our spiritual development. And in Buddhism, this is a key part of our path, is to recognize that there are ways of behaving in the world, conduct that we need to follow, that is conducive to creating the causes for happiness and avoiding those for suffering. Of course, in the Buddhist tradition, this is very much rooted in the concept of karma, and we'll be talking about karma as part of this weekend. So the very foundation when it comes down to it is the higher training of morality. But in this presentation that we are looking at, we can say that that is going to be taught second. And the reason why is because it does require some level of wisdom to begin to even approach morality. So when we talk about that sort of corpus of the Buddha's teachings, the training of wisdom, we're talking about everything that we have to learn about to begin to develop some understanding of, to begin to incorporate into how we see the world, our worldview and so on, how we act within the world comes from that worldview. And so the higher training in wisdom in this presentation comes first, but when it comes down to our actual practice, we can say that our practice of morality is the foundation or the bedrock upon which the other two trainings are actually built. The third of these, that's actually third on the list here at the top, is the higher training of concentration, or we could call this meditation or meditative stabilization. Meditation, again, is also a good part of all the Eastern traditions, not quite as much in Western traditions of spirituality, but there is a need recognized for us to have a calmer, more focused mind in order to develop the wisdom at a much deeper level, in order to change our minds, to actually achieve deeper states of well-being and so on. So when we kind of divide it in this way, and I'll be going into this in a lot more detail, this is just to give a real sort of cursory overview, we can say that everything that the Buddha taught, and even when we divide what the Buddha taught into what are called the three baskets, we see that there are one basket that's called Vinaya, which pertains primarily to morality. We have another basket that is called the Sutra basket, which is primarily those teachings that help us to develop concentration. And then the third basket of the Buddha's teachings are all what's called Abhidharma. And Abhidharma is higher knowledge. You know, it includes all of the wisdom teachings that the Buddha gave. So the Buddhist path really can be summarized in terms of these three. And these trainings in our Lam Rim presentation, just for those of you who have a grounding in that, these are usually taught as part of the middle scope when we talk about achieving liberation. And the goal of liberation, of being free from all of our suffering and achieving the state of nirvana, complete pacification of all of the negative aspects of our minds, this is achieved through these three higher trainings. And that's the context for where they are taught in the Lam Rim. As I said, when I go through it through this weekend, we're going to be looking at it not just in that more traditional way that it's presented in terms of how we achieve our own freedom from suffering, but moreover, how do we achieve the greater goal? the greater goal of what we call enlightenment or Buddhahood. So maybe I need to give a little background for those of you who are a little bit new in terms of what we mean by these two different goals, because we will be talking about them again in almost every one of these subjects in terms of how we contribute to achieving what we would call liberation and how we would achieve what's called enlightenment. So the Buddha, in his wisdom and also his compassion, you know, didn't teach just one sort of single goal for sentient beings, for beings like ourselves. The Buddha, in his compassion, realized that there were some individuals who were able to adopt a much more far-reaching and all-encompassing goal. And that's the goal of Buddhahood. That's what we practice in Tibetan Buddhism here, is this idea that each of us has the potential to awaken ourselves fully to a state exactly identical to what the Buddha was. The Buddha in Buddhism isn't some creator god, some being that is beyond us completely, but rather a being that we can achieve the same state as if we practice that same path. So the goal of complete enlightenment, or Buddhahood, is a goal that is attainable by all of us. But it's said, again, that the Buddha saw that there were individuals who perhaps didn't have the wherewithal and the capacity to be able to carry that burden of the welfare of all beings and become a Buddha, kind of have that focus initially at least. And so he taught a path that leads to what we generally call liberation, or sometimes more technically we'd say it's individual liberation. And the idea behind that is that beings who practice that, who have that type of disposition, are actually able to achieve, through primarily, again, these three higher trainings, the cessation of their own suffering, an end to their own suffering, removing everything that is negative in the mind, and achieving that state of peace that comes with the attainment of nirvana. So this is said to be a somewhat lesser goal, but it's not really meant to say that one is superior and the other is inferior, but rather that these are, again, two separate paths that were taught by the Buddha, one that can be practiced by those who don't feel that they can take on that heavier burden at that time, who can achieve some liberation from their own suffering. You know, and how wonderful, there's one less person, one less being suffering in samsara, this term that refers to our going from life to life. If we're able to achieve that, then that means one less person causing suffering to others to some degree as well, one less person that's controlled by those negative states of mind and engaging in unskillful behavior. So when we talk about that path, that is a very valid path, and there are those individuals who feel inclined to practice that. It may even be some of you in the room who feel like at this juncture, that's really what compels you to be here, is to understand what is necessary in order to have an end to your own suffering. And as I said, how wonderful you can achieve that through the Buddha's path. The second goal, which was the first one I mentioned earlier, though, is, again, what we adopt in Tibetan Buddhism, is the idea that we have the capacity to actually go beyond nirvana, to actually attain a state where we aren't kind of solely preoccupied with our own liberation, but rather become occupied with the liberation of all beings from their suffering. We become dedicated to that greater goal of Buddhahood and attaining the state where we have the capacity then to help all sentient beings to achieve that. And so this is the context that I'm going to be adding to the teachings as we go through them. As I said, I'll present them in the more traditional way in terms of how they're taught within the Theravadan tradition, which I don't want to say is exclusively about people attaining their own liberation. I've never practiced that path, so I can't speak to what the individuals who are coming from the Theravadan tradition are practicing. But it does seem to be that generally this is the path that they are following, is one that leads to their own liberation. And that's the term that I'll use whenever I'm talking about that goal, is liberation. Whereas the goal of enlightenment, or Buddhahood, is the greater goal, the goal where it does mean taking on that additional burden of achieving enlightenment, going through all of the rigorous trainings that are involved in that, and then eventually attaining a state where we can truly help others way beyond the capacity that we have currently. So again, these teachings are going to be coming from both of those orientations. In this presentation that you have in the first point there, where it says, you know, again, first the higher training of wisdom, then the higher training of morality, and then finally concentration, this is how they are laid out in the traditional path to liberation in the Theravadan tradition, is to recognize that we do require some level of wisdom before we can even embark on our path. And if we look at it, this is true for all of us. If any of you, again, some of you in the room certainly said that you're already on a Buddhist path, feel comfortable with this path, it came about because of your own development of some knowledge about this path. You can't really sort of sign up for practicing the other trainings without having some level of wisdom, some knowledge. You might call that a more preliminary knowledge. But the goal eventually is to attain a much deeper state of knowledge, a deeper state of awareness that will actually be useful in getting us to the full goal of either liberation or enlightenment. But on the basis of that preliminary understanding that we develop, developing an intention to achieve liberation, we can then go on to practice the higher training of morality, which, as we can see, is divided into three areas: our verbal actions, our right speech, right action, which is our physical actions, actions of body, and so on, and then right livelihood, which is our means of, you know, having a living, and even the focus on that, which is not, you know, there as frequently in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but which is quite useful to take a look at in terms of how it's presented in the Theravadan tradition. On the basis of practicing good morality, which again is rooted in some understanding of the path, we then will be able to have a stronger foundation for developing the third training, the training in concentration. And by concentration, we simply mean the ability for the mind to focus, the mind to be single-pointed. And all of you mentioned some level of exposure to meditation. Meditation, in essence, can be divided into two main practices, and this is referring to the first of those, what we call our sort of practices in stabilization, in making the mind very single-pointed, undistracted, capable of penetrating very deeply into the subjects that we are developing the wisdom around. So we need a foundation of concentration eventually to come back around, and that's why this idea of the wheel or the circle, to come back around to developing a much deeper level of wisdom, to actually be able to penetrate into the teachings and fundamentally change our mind. So I did want to read from a few books. I'll mention a few books that I'll be referring to here and there in these teachings that pertain to the Eightfold Path. And this is a book by Bhikkhu Bodhi that's actually called, let me get the title up here, The Noble Eightfold Path, The Way to the End of Suffering. This is the passage right at the beginning of that text where he does kind of explain, well, because as I'm going to point out when we get to the bottom there, we frequently talk about morality as being the foundation for developing concentration and then on the basis of that developing wisdom. So why is wisdom kind of there first? You know, why is this kind of set out as the initial part of the Theravadan presentation of this? He says, perplexity sometimes arises over an apparent inconsistency in the arrangement of the path factors in the threefold training. Wisdom, which includes, you know, right understanding or right view and right intention, is the last stage in the threefold training. As I said at the very bottom of the page, it shows how they're actually done in terms of our training, is that we need to have morality as our basis, develop concentration from that, and develop the deeper wisdom from that more focused, single-pointed mind. So there is some confusion if we look at it and see how we actually practice it versus how it is set out in this presentation that we're, again, going to be primarily working from over the course of this weekend. He says, yet its factors are placed at the beginning of the path rather than at its end, as might be expected according to the canon of strict consistency. So wisdom is at the beginning, and yet, you know, again, as we practice it, wisdom is developed last. The sequence of the path factors, he says, however, is not the result of a careless slip, but is determined by an important logistical consideration, namely that right view and right intention of a preliminary type are called for at the outset as the spur for entering the threefold training. Right view provides the perspective for practice, right intention, the sense of direction. But the two do not expire in this preparatory role, for when the mind has been refined by the training in moral discipline and morality, and then in concentration, it arrives at a superior right view and right intention, which now form the proper training in the higher wisdom. So in essence, what we have, again, as I was mentioning earlier, by seeing it as a sort of a circle, we have to develop some awareness, some wisdom, some understanding, and even some intention on the basis of that understanding that acts as the impetus to get us on the path. to actually begin to engage in the higher training of morality, and then to engage in the higher training in concentration. And on the basis of that, we can then kind of return to the wisdom teachings, return to everything that the Buddha set out, and increase our understanding to what he called, again, a superior view, as opposed to a more preliminary view. And as my own experience is that this continues to be circular. You know, every time that we go back through and understand the wisdom teachings to some degree and begin to become more familiar with them, we have a greater impetus and understanding as to why we practice morality. And our morality becomes stronger, and then we are able to develop our concentration more deeply. And then we are able to penetrate more deeply into the wisdom. And then we can influence our morality. So it very much circles around and feeds one into the other. So in the presentation that we're going to be doing this weekend, we're actually going to follow the way that they're set out in that first section. We'll be looking tonight, we'll begin this examination of right view or understanding. I don't know if we'll have time to touch on right intention or thought, but we'll certainly move into that after that. Go through the three that are set out for higher training of morality that I mentioned earlier. And then we will continue on as we go through the latter part of the weekend to look at right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation or concentration, which is, although this is the higher training of concentration, this is a sub-point within it that is really about developing that the correct or right focus in terms of our meditative practice. Another way to look at these, by the way, in terms of how they're titled, right is kind of a loaded word. It implies that there's a wrong, right? Right? Anyway, so the idea maybe that might be more useful is to see them as skillful, and this is actually the word that's used in another book that I'm going to be referring to frequently. It's actually called, I think that one's called Eight Steps to Happiness, and that's by, I can never remember his full name, and he actually calls them skillful. So we have skillful mindfulness and skillful view and skillful intention and so on. Eight Mindful Steps to Happiness, Walking the Buddha's Path. And again, the author of that is Henipola Gunaratana. Some of you may know his name. He actually wrote, the book on mindfulness that is very popular in the Theravadan tradition. So any questions so far on what I've talked about in terms of kind of introducing, just barely talking about the Eightfold Path, but setting them out at least within these three categories, these three trainings. Yes, Diane.
I've been kind of starting on the Eightfold Path. Didn't know that that was the way you start, but had a lot of difficulty with the term right, because it's right and then not right. And then you get trapped in all this mess.
Yeah.
And one of the readings that I've been doing suggested the word beneficial.
I was wondering
how that sits with what you're saying with skillful.
Okay. I think beneficial is perfectly fine as well, Diane. It's maybe even up to each of us to figure out what works for us most. Another one that I see presented occasionally is correct, but correct has a lot of that same connotation as right.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what we're really talking about, because we're not trying to say that the way that other paths and other spiritual traditions are wrong, we're simply saying that this is the Buddhist perspective and the Buddha's own knowledge in terms of how to make one's life more skillful.
Mm-hmm.
And skillful is a really wonderful word. Beneficial is a good word because it implies, again, that we do gain some benefit by practicing these eight steps. And I'm hoping that you'll see all that through as we go through the weekend, is to really recognize that these things are all very, very useful for us. We can have a happier life when we're actually applying them at that level. So I think beneficial is a great word. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a good suggestion. Yeah. Anyone else? Any other questions on this? So again, those of you who have a Lamrim background maybe already have a step ahead, but if there are any questions really from anyone, I'm happy to take those. Yeah, Denise?
So I'm trying to get a handle on how to think about this in context of six perfections, since half the words are the same. Right? So I mean, morality, ethics, we're talking about the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have generally the same order that we have on the bottom of the page. For but we've only picked out several. So is one inside the other, or does it make sense to try to look at them together or not?
Yeah. So again, those of you who are new, you're getting lots of numbers already tonight, right? You got 3 and 8, and now here's 6. So we talked about 4 numbers.
If you want to postpone that till later, that's fine.
No, we will be touching on this because, again, to extend the understanding of the Eightfold Path into the Mahayana tradition, which does include the 6 perfections, are actually taught as a practice of the Bodhisattva, the being who is striving for enlightenment, for that greater goal. The 6 perfections are definitely a way of framing one's path as well. And as you said, they would fit very neatly into the first 4 to some degree, maybe even 3, being quite involved in one's practice of morality. Those 6 perfections, by the way, for those of you who haven't heard them delineated, are the perfection of generosity, the perfection of morality, and the perfection of patience. And so all 3 of those are ways that we interact with other beings, ways that we try to be most beneficial to them, non-harmful to them. And so generosity, by being very open with our resources and our knowledge and so on. And then morality, which is all of what we're going to talk about, certainly in regard to right speech and right action, even right livelihood. And then patience, which is also a quality that we need in interacting with others so that we're not getting upset and angry and causing, you know, inflammation between ourselves and others and so on. So again, this is a neat way of sort of fitting them into morality. Effort, which is the 4th of the 6 perfections, we can see it listed as one of the trainings here under the higher training of concentration, but effort is actually needed throughout our path, no matter what we're embarking upon. And so we fit it maybe into concentration, but perhaps also maybe even into wisdom. And then finally, of course, concentration, which is the 5th perfection, would be neatly into that 2nd training. And then the 6th perfection of wisdom would, of course, be the last of the 3 higher trainings at the bottom of the page. So there is a way to kind of encapsulate them within this, and we will touch on that as we go through this.
Thank you. That makes sense. I can draw the chart now.
Okay. Are you the chart person for Kadampa Center? We had one person who was our chart person over in the master's program in Italy when I studied. So our go-to person for charts. Any other questions on this? Again, it'll become a little clearer, too, as we work with each of these individually and begin to explore them. Let me see if there was anything else I wanted to share in regard to... Okay, I had one other quote, and this one is from the other book that I'd mentioned, the Eight Steps to a Happy Life, I think. I don't know, it's maybe the title of this course. Got to look at the title of the book, 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness. Okay, so let me go to this little quote that, again, kind of... just reemphasizes what I said earlier, and it's good to hear it maybe in slightly different words. This is again from Henapola Gunaratana. Though I have presented the Buddha's path as a series of sequential stages, it actually works more like a spiral. Morality, concentration, and wisdom reinforce and deepen each other. Each of the 8 steps on the path deepens and reinforces the others as well. As you begin to practice the path as a whole, each step unfolds, and each wholesome action or insight gives impetus to the next. Along the way, everything about you changes, especially your tendency to blame others for your unhappiness. With each turn of the spiral, you accept more responsibility for your intentional thoughts, words, and deeds, and so on. So this is really, again, giving a good context for why we're looking at this subject and what I'm hoping it will be, you know, for you as you go through this weekend, to be able to see how these do increase your happiness, because you begin to understand that the tools for creating happiness are within your own reach. They are things that you can actually engage in, and you can begin to see the results as you practice each of these 8 steps. So let's go ahead and start and get into our exploration of the very first of these steps that is involved with the higher training of wisdom. This one, again, could be called skillful view or skillful understanding. Again, lots of different ways of presenting this. I ended up just using right because it was the one that was on the little graphic on the front page, but we'll replace that with skillful frequently or beneficial, since I do prefer those words. So when we talk about kind of what does it mean to have mindful, skillful view, this entails developing an understanding of the Buddhist teachings, including especially the following topics. Now, I've added to what some of the traditional presentations show, and that's because I want to make sure that we all have a kind of common grounding in a lot of what is being talked about over the course of this weekend. The very first topic that's on your sheet there, on this set of black and white sheets, for step one is mind, the nature of mind and the potential that the mind has for true happiness. And again, this is necessary simply because we do have people in the room who maybe don't have as much of a grounding in this topic. While I'm sure a number of you have studied this topic of mind before, as I mentioned in the motivation that we did tonight, mind is really the Buddha's expertise. Could identify the Buddha as maybe the first psychologist that ever existed because he really wanted to reveal the nature of our minds to us. When we talk about mind, the very first thing we need to do is to define what we mean by mind. Does anyone know the definition of mind that's set out in Buddhism? And be happy to share that. Anyone? Great, that which is clear in knowing. Thanks, Jill. So when we talk about the definition, we first talk about the nature of mind, which is its clarity or luminosity. The idea is that the implication is that mind isn't anything material or physical. You know, in the Western approaches to understanding the mind and neuroscience and so on, they tend to focus a lot on the neurological system, the gray matter in our brains and all the electrochemical responses that are going on there and everything involved in the physical components of what produces consciousness to some degree. In Buddhist terms, though, that's only a condition for consciousness. Consciousness itself, which I'm equating to mind in this context, so these three terms, awareness, consciousness, or mind, can all be equated, is really referring to its own kind of substantial causes that are giving rise to mental moments, one after another, always a moment following, always a moment that preceded it. And so when we talk about this very first aspect of mind, its nature of clarity, we mean that it is something that can be identified as having no real physicality to it at all, and that it is sort of luminous, illuminating, allowing us to engage in the function of mind, which is its ability to know, which is the second part of the definition. So mind is that which is clear and knowing. By knowing, we mean that it is able to have objects appear to it through that sort of clarity or luminosity. In some ways, we could say the mind is like a mirror, in that everything that kind of arises, kind of appears to the mind, is part of what the mind observes and comes to know or understand. But obviously, you know, the mind has more abilities beyond a mirror. It's not simply taking things in a very one-at-a-time kind of way. The mind is a very powerful tool that we have that can be used to change the mind itself focusing on mind and on its own tendencies and traits and so on. So understanding the nature of mind is really an important part of our path, because the implications, of course, behind this idea of mind being non-physical is that when the physical components of this body cease, when the electrochemical stuff all stops at the end of this life, when breathing stops, when brain functions stop, mind continues on. There is still a process that's going on of new moments of mind arising. And this is the logic for understanding past and future lives, is the idea that there is no beginning to this process, every moment of mind having arisen from a previous moment of mind. Mind needing that kind of substantial cause for it to arise. There's a wonderful explanation of this. I didn't bring it with me in His Holiness's book called The Universe in a Single Atom, where he talks about this idea of needing a substantial cause. If we talked about something like this wooden kind of ringer for the chime, we can see that this has a substantial cause. What would be the substantial or main primary cause of this? Universe in a single atom. What would be the substantial or main cause? By substantial or main, we mean the principal thing that this arises from. Wood. Very good. So it's coming from a tree, from the wood of a tree that was cut down, and at some point lots of other conditions became involved in making it into this brown dowel that, you know, it's got smooth sides and it's been varnished and, you know, what have you, all of the various causes and conditions. The main cause or the primary cause for this is the wood that it is made from. And lots of other conditions involved, right? But the main one or the substantial one is the wood. Well, when it comes to mind, what His Holiness says is that mind is non-physical. It's not the same nature as this body. So it has to have a substantial cause, a main cause, that is also not physical. It kind of makes sense when we delineate mind in that way. We see that it actually requires something that is the same nature as it, just like this dowel, you know, ringer, you know, needing to have wood that it is made from, because it's a wooden dowel. It is having that as its substantial cause. Everything that is physical has its own substantial cause, right? If we talk about our own bodies, for example, there were two cells that came together in your mother's womb that formed the substantial basis for what you have as a body now. Those two cells have long since, you know, been replaced by other cells. But if it wasn't for that beginning physical matter that came from your parents, you wouldn't have this body, this whole continuity of stuff that we call body. So our bodies arose from something that was very similar in nature, the cells of the bodies of our parents. So when we go back to mind, we see that mind also has to arise from something that is of a similar nature, something that is in the same substance as it, which means that it has to arise from something that isn't physical, because mind itself isn't physical. So in this way, His Holiness kind of points out in a much more elaborate way than what I've done, the whole need for explaining mind as arising always from a previous moment of mind, and of course, continuing to give rise to future moments of mind. Now, even with that type of explanation, this isn't an absolute proof of past and future lives, but it is a way to begin to use some understanding as to how we can posit the existence of past lives, the existence of future lives, which maybe is not absolutely essential to practice the Buddhist path, but it's a very useful dimension to practicing the Buddhist path. Why? Because without that, the principle of karma is a little short-sighted. I mean, we don't really understand everything, because if everything comes from simply actions in this life, it's kind of hard to understand why we have some of the experiences that we have. If it requires past lives and is fed by past lives, then we've got a larger dimension to draw from in terms of our experiences. As I said, we'll talk about karma as part of this course. I'll certainly be getting into it shortly, since it's the next topic. But the understanding of mind and kind of beginning to become aware of the fact that mind has this continuity also gives us a much longer perspective then too, right? I mean, we don't have to do all the work in this lifetime. It's good to do as much of the work as we can, but there are future lives that we can continue this work, and it may take for many of us a number of lives to actually attain these states of either liberation or enlightenment. But let's talk a little bit about then that potential that we have for attaining what we would call true happiness, which could be at the level of liberation, could also certainly be the more far-reaching happiness that is attainable through the state of enlightenment or Buddhahood. So why is that possible? Why does the mind have that potential? His Holiness, in one of his teachings, talks about the fact that we can say that this is rooted in two fundamental ideas. One is the fact that the mind itself is also impermanent. And by impermanent, we don't mean that it kind of comes into existence and goes out of existence, like a lot of things that are impermanent. Rather, we mean that it is changing all the time, because mind never goes out of existence. Mind continues on. You will never have an end to your mind, just like you never had a beginning to your mind. But rather, what we mean by this is that mind is a changing phenomenon. And look at how many different thoughts you've had just in the course of the last hour or so, right? Lots of different, you know, feelings, thoughts, sensations, everything going through this horizon that we call the mind, arising and falling away. This is indicative of the process of change that is always there. It's kind of happening in the mind all the time. Impermanence is a key concept that the Buddha taught, and we will be touching on that concept as we go through this course as well. It's an important one to have some understanding of. The impermanence of the mind means that the mind can change, means that the mind is not fixed. We like to think of ourselves in a very fixed way, right? Oh, I'm just angry. That's just the way I am, or whatever the case might be, whatever, fill in the blank there instead of angry. But that is not really the nature of our minds. Our minds are changing all the time, and we actually have the potential to influence that change. How can we influence that change? This is rooted in the other idea that His Holiness taught. He says that basically the mind can be transformed. We have a potential for real happiness. Why? Because the mind is impermanent, and also because what he calls the law of contradiction. Let's look at what that means, what the implications of that are. The law of contradiction means that we can actually induce states of mind that are contradictory to the ones that are not so skillful. And that's a lot of what we're trying to do over the course of this weekend, is to understand that we've been going about living our lives in very unskillful ways, non-beneficial ways, even harmful ways to ourselves and harmful to others. And those are rooted in various patterns that we have in our minds. We call those, in Buddhist terms, the delusions, the afflictions, the negative emotions. They include things like anger and jealousy and pride and greed and ignorance and all of these things that are essentially flavoring our minds to create more discontentment rather than to create the causes for real happiness. All of those states of mind have contradictory states of mind. You can match them up. You know, you can see that hatred is overcome by love, and greed is overcome by generosity, a generous mind, and ignorance is overcome by wisdom, and so on. All of these negative states of mind can be contradicted by positive states of mind, by skillful states of mind. And moreover, His Holiness points out that in the presence of these skillful states of mind that are rooted in truth, rooted in reality, these unskillful states of mind can eventually be eliminated completely. Why? Because they are not rooted in reality. They are not things that we find to be true when we investigate them. That's, again, going to be a good part of what we look at this weekend, is to examine those things that are actually much more beneficial for us and see that we can replace our habitual ways of looking at things in these unskillful mindsets with things that are much, much more beneficial, that will actually lead to greater and greater well-being and happiness. So through this law of contradiction, we can replace negative states of mind and negative tendencies with those that are beneficial, fruitful, skillful. And we can, as I said, eventually overcome them. Now, the process that we're looking at, going back to that initial handout, this whole idea of the three higher trainings, is the way that we completely eliminate them. By having that foundation in good morality, being able to develop a deep concentration, because it's only with very powerful single-pointed concentration that we can change the mind in that more fundamental way, and then adding that element of wisdom, being able to introduce at the deepest level the wisdom that overcomes all of our ignorance that the Buddha says all of these negative states of mind are rooted in. So, in essence, by just understanding the nature of mind and the potential that we have for happiness, we have already a sort of preview of everything that we're going to be looking at. You know, all of the skillful, positive states, all those behaviors that we want to adopt that will help us to eventually eliminate everything that has simply been causing us more and more headaches, more and more problems, more and more suffering. So the nature of mind and kind of having that idea of the potential that we possess is a really important foundation to have. Any questions or comments on that? Yes, Tim. Oh, and then we'll come to you. Yes, Naga.
Yeah. You were talking about the contradiction of mind, and it's something I thought about. I don't know, it might be an easy answer, but we're talking about training our minds to overcome these negative actions. How come we have those negative actions? How come the good ones didn't develop? Is it society or, you know, like jealousy, anger? Mm-hmm. It's so easy to get those, but we have to train for those good ones, you know. Why are those in place and we have to overcome them, vice versa, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's one perennial question that we always have is like, well, how do we get into this mess in the first place? Why do we have such a preponderance of the negative states of mind, and why have we simply been in this cycle of creating those and strengthening those? If this has been going on since beginningless time, why is that the case? I don't know if the Buddha ever had a very neat answer for that. I mean, certainly we can see that, again, we are going to tend to, if we examine the mind, we can see that we tend to be in line with those things that we become most familiar with. So the answer at a very simple level is why we are that way is because we have been that way. And so we've created that type of a karmic effect through never really doing anything to address any of those. Now, again, in this presentation that we're getting into as we go through this, and we'll start to understand the deeper cause of all of this, which, as I mentioned, alluded to just a few minutes ago, is our ignorance. So that removing that ignorance is actually something we have to become quite aware of, that we even have that ignorance, because we're all walking around with that ignorance. The Buddha says every sentient being has that ignorance at a very deep level. And where that ignorance came from is only prior moments of ignorance. It's not something that we made a choice at some point, oh, I'm going to be ignorant. I'm going to start thinking about things in this fictitious way. Rather, we've always had this with us. And on the basis of that, with everything rooted in that, we have created at times very positive states of mind. We wouldn't actually all be here, the Buddha says, as human beings sitting in this room listening to these teachings if we hadn't created positive actions in the past, if we didn't have skillful states of mind. So we are a combination of those things. But until we get rid of the root, which is driving so many of the negative emotions, and often together even with some of our positive ones, until we get rid of that root of ignorance, we can't be free of all of those. We can't completely do away with all the negative states of mind. This is kind of an interesting thing, that all the negative states of mind have to be rooted in that ignorance. And I'll talk about that ignorance as we get into these teachings more deeply. Tonight's maybe too early to introduce that, you know, at this stage. But the positive states of mind, as I said, can still be with that ignorance, but they don't depend upon that ignorance. They can actually flourish with wisdom, and they become even more powerful with wisdom. But we have to have that wisdom maybe as an impetus to get them to strengthen to the degree where we will actually tend more towards the positive, and the negative will begin to fall away and become less and less prominent. So I don't know that, again, there's a very neat answer to that, other than the fact that it's all rooted in our past behavior, and we haven't come across the teachings that have allowed us to actually overcome all of the roots of our suffering and all of the suffering that arises from it. So, yeah, I wish it was otherwise. None of us in the room came in, you know, with we all might come in with varying degrees of knowledge, but every one of us has, to some extent, that level of ignorance. So yeah, Nugget, did you still have a question? Then the microphone's right there. Yeah.
So my question is, if I always think on the grounds of poverty, because I'm studying on poverty. So if Buddha's mind is enlightened, all the Buddha practitioners, and I feel like them being in poverty is actually creates suffering to the people who are supposed to be generous to Buddhas. So I feel like, how come all these enlightened Buddhas don't realize that generosity can also create suffering to the people who are being generous?
I'm not sure I'm getting the question completely, but this idea of parity maybe isn't quite there in Buddhism to that degree. I mean, if we look at what a Buddha is, let's talk about what a Buddha is. A Buddha is a being who was just like us at some point in time. You know, wherever we are on the path, the Buddha was there at some point as a being just like us.
Right.
Who has developed all of these qualities to the degree where their whole job description, if you will, is to enlighten other beings. And they moreover have the power to do that by influencing them in whatever ways are possible. But of course they're limited to some degree by the beings that they're trying to benefit, because the beings are only going to benefit to the degree that they're capable. So every one of us is under the influence of what we would call these enlightened beings. Enlightened beings have been in the world since beginningless time as well, trying to enlighten others, trying to help them on their paths. And any actions that sentient beings, who are those that are unenlightened, that any actions that sentient beings engage in under the influence of Buddhas that are positive in nature eventually will lead to the result of their enlightenment, you know, through accumulating more positive potential, eventually meeting teachings that help them to develop their minds, eventually becoming fully enlightened just like the Buddhas, and then they join the ranks of the Buddhas. And
so then we all go into poverty?
To some degree. And again, you can say that Buddhas exist because there are suffering sentient beings, but it doesn't mean that because Buddhas exist, sentient beings suffer. It's rather the idea that this is just the nature of this world that we are involved in. those of us in the room, maybe some of you in the room are Buddhas. I don't know. I mean, none of us knows who is a Buddha. But the idea is if we are sentient beings, then we are suffering due to our own delusions and our own ignorance and all of the things that are arising, all the actions we engage in and so on. This is what we're going to look at in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So the idea is that we are in that state of creating our own suffering. Buddhas have transcended that. They've exited it, and moreover, they have the ability to help us. So they're a force that's very powerful in a positive way, helping us on our path that leads to, again, joining their ranks and helping them. So there's really not, again, maybe the full concept of parity, but rather that this is just, there are sentient beings, there are Buddhas. Those that are in this, you know, unenlightened state and those that are in the enlightened state. And all the actions that they're engaging in to help from the side of Buddhas are all beneficial in the end. Can't say that in the end that they result in any harm to sentient beings. Sentient beings are harmed by virtue of their own delusions, but everything that the Buddhas do is to help them to be free of that. So I don't know if that helps. Yeah, Susie.
Don't the Buddhas give us an opportunity to practice generosity then?
Sure, sure. That they can be a platform for doing that themselves, and they can also encourage us to do that for other sentient beings, you know, to be generous to other beings. So, absolutely. This is one reason why we use imagery here, is that we, you know, these images are not just material that has come from the earth or something. They are representative and said to be the very embodiment of the Buddhas. And so we have them as a platform to be able to practice acts of generosity by making water bowl offerings and so on. But again, the Buddhas are a very important part of this whole dynamic of samsara, you know, our state of going from life to life, and those beings who have again transcended that and have every intention of helping us on our path. They don't have anything else to do. I mean, that's their job description, like I said. When you become enlightened, it's enlighten all other beings. That's it. That's your... You don't even like get up in the morning and think that. That is what you operate from. That is what you are as a being, is that energy in the world that is helping others to become enlightened. It's a good question. Yes. Ernie, right? No. Barry. Ernie's over there.
Just one real quick question. Maybe your thoughts on this. Your mind is a separate entity, and your brain is separate. So... your brain and your mind work separately, but your mind is all thoughts. How do they relate to each other?
I wouldn't say that they work completely separately. I would say that, again, they have their own continuity in terms of these substantial causes, but they're very much interdependent. I think His Holiness would say, yes, absolutely. You know, when he meets with these neuroscientists and so on in the Mind Life conferences, it's not to say that what's going on in the physicality has nothing to do with what's going on in our mentality, but rather that the two are very much interactive. We can even see this in terms of, you know, the whole concept of neuroplasticity that's been shown to be quite valid, that through the way that you think and the thought processes that you induce through your mentality, you can change the physical matter of your brain. You know, there is that plasticity at that level. So, and it goes vice versa. I mean, they have experiments where they probe certain parts of the brain and you have a mental experience of perhaps reliving some memory from the past or having a particular emotion or what have you arise. And so we could say that there are definitely interactions between these two, interconnectedness. But we would say that they are still functioning kind of parallel
separately,
to each other,
yeah,
somewhat separately, but yet parallel and interconnected.
Your thoughts influence your brain.
Absolutely. And your brain, to some degree, influences the thoughts. In His Holiness, in one of these books that documents some of the dialogue he's had with these scientists, actually did ask him that question, because they were coming from the point of view primarily in Western science as things that happen to the brain induce thoughts. It always starts with an electrochemical response that induces a thought or feeling or sensation, whatever. And His Holiness says, well, but doesn't it go the other way too? And many at the time and that conference happened were like, no, it doesn't. But I think they've come to understand that it does. These two are very much interdependent.
Because when you die, your brain stops, but your mind still keeps going on.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Barry. All right, so let's talk a little bit about karma. Mind is an important topic to understand the whole arena in which the Buddha's teachings are meant to be applied, and to have an understanding of the mind is essential, as I said. karma is the other really key concept. Karma, of course, is one that we've simplified to some degree in the West, and so we've made it into a concept like what goes around comes around, or these very simple phrases. And those don't really embody the full measure of what we mean by karma. Karma technically really refers to cause as opposed to cause and effect. We use it as shorthand to refer to the law of cause and effect. But really what we're talking about are the causes, which in essence are our mental movements of mind, you know, that sort of the way that the mind moves in particular directions towards various objects induced by many of these mental states, that creates a sort of energy that ripens into various experiences. That's where we often call it that law of cause and effect, because it is referring to the way that we experience effects, the way that we have various physical experiences, mental experiences. Everything that happens to you is a product of karma, a product of the actions that you've done in the past. And of course, trying to explain, well, how do those connect and how does this all happen? It's a very, again, the Buddha didn't go to that level of detail in actually delineating how all this happens. But I like to think of karma really as energy, and it's not really how it's defined in the traditional text. We mean kind of an energy, a mental energy that we sort of put out in a particular direction. And in a sense, a bit like a boomerang, that, you know, energy comes back around to affect us in the future. It affects us at the moment, too, though. We can see that the particular choices that we make in terms of actions that we engage in and so on can have an effect on the happiness that we experience in the moment. We don't feel so good if we lie to somebody, for example. Most of us, some people in the world, lie all the time and don't think anything about it. But I won't name any names. But, but you know, again, the idea is that what we're really talking about is those seeds that we plant that are unwholesome and unskillful that do come back around, but they don't. It's not a real linear thing. It's not like a boomerang that we throw and it comes back around and it's the same boomerang. Rather, in the law of cause and effect, it's manifold. There's many different results that we experience on the basis of our actions. And, of course, that has its ramifications for both those that are positive in a good way and those that are not so skillful in a somewhat bad way, because we can compound our suffering by engaging in unskillful actions. But the law of cause and effect is the underpinning by which we are able to use that impermanence of the mind and this law of contradiction to actually make changes and experience those changes, because nothing's lost in the law of cause and effect. Everything that we do with our minds, everything that we do with our speech, with our physical actions, none of that is lost. Everything is captured as a part of that process, and if we gain control over those three avenues of our minds, our speech, and our bodies, which are frequently called the three doors, we are able to actually experience different results in our lives, able to create a greater state of happiness in the moment, as well as even in future lives, as well as the happiness that transcends that whole experience of going from life to life, the happiness of nirvana or liberation, and the happiness of enlightenment, Buddhahood. So again, the law of cause and effect is really extremely relevant. Karma is a very important principle in understanding how we create happiness. Because of the law of cause and effect, we can have an effect on our future experiences. We can even have an effect on our present experiences. As I said, we will feel better if we're truthful with others, if we're actually kinder to others, and so on. So I'm going to touch on karma here and there as we get into the training in morality and those three steps. But any questions on just what we mean by karma in a real preliminary way? I'm sorry, I'm making you get up often, Susie. Sorry. Any questions on karma? By the way, this word karma is a Sanskrit word that technically just means action. So by that we mean the action of our body, speech, or mind that kind of sets in motion this whole process by which we experience those results. Yes, Scott.
I have one aspect of karma that bugs me, and that's
probably
about
me too.
Natural disasters,
yes,
that affect masses of people.
Yeah.
Can you touch on that?
Yeah, I can touch on it. Can I explain it? I don't know that I can. I mean, there are certain Buddhist teachers who actually say that falls outside of the law of karma and falls more into natural effects that are due to just living in the natural world. But in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I don't know that that's quite how they hold those things, because they would say that all the experiences that we have, which would include where you have like what happened with the tsunami in Thailand and Indonesia and all of the people who were affected by that, some to greater degrees than others, that they would say that that is a karmic ripening of some sort. Now, because there were a large number of people that experienced it somewhat simultaneously due to the same causes, they would probably also call it a collective karma, meaning that it was something that that group of people, which sounds even more outrageous, somehow created together in some past life, in some collection, they did something that harmed other beings, that harmed the environment, and they are experiencing the ramifications of that. Beyond that, it's really hard to explain those sorts of things. I mean, even if you talk about not just natural disasters, but even things like the Holocaust, you know, and so many people that were affected by that from different backgrounds and so on, and it becomes, you don't want to go to this extreme of just sort of shrugging it off and saying, well, it was their karma and they just experienced it. We have to understand that there's a lot more dimensions to this that we need to be aware of, and of course the whole dimension of having compassion for beings who are experiencing natural disasters, who are experiencing man-made harm and so on, and understanding that every being can be free of that eventually by removing the causes of that, and we should never lose our compassion in those situations. But it's very hard to explain those things in a very linear way. But keep in mind that karma is also, it isn't that linear. It really is very dynamic. And we have many other causes and conditions that influence things and that have a part of creating that effect. So, were you going to say anything?
I was just going to say we're all experiencing the collective karma of global warming.
Yeah, yeah. What's happening with the climate change on the planet is definitely a product. We can say there are physical things that scientists have identified that have contributed to that, but there's also mental states that have created karma that are causing that appearance of having the world change and, you know, the ice caps melt and what have you, all of this going on in our world. So, absolutely. Okay, we're at 8:30, so we need to wrap it up pretty soon, but Kim, did you have one other... I don't want to keep people here too late. So.
And you can just put this to one side. But I would just wonder what your thoughts are on the fact that, you know, there's a lot of talk in the Buddhist traditions of past, present, and future, the three times.
Sure.
If karma is not necessarily linear, but we talk about it like that very frequently.
Sure.
Because I think my understanding is that we don't really understand, or at least I don't really understand enough about it to be able to talk about it in other dimensions.
Right.
But, you know, I've often wondered how does the fact that we talk about it like this kind of come into contact with, you know, Einstein, who is one of the kind of greatest minds about our physical nature, when he talks about time as not necessarily being linear and you know, kind of like a warp, and so it's not the way we necessarily think about it. So I just wondered, have you ever considered that at all?
You know, whenever I get questions about time, my head starts going, I'm going to check out or something.
We can put it to one side. That's okay.
Well,
I'll
give you just one or two comments.
Okay.
And one is that, you know, there is obviously a temporal dimension to karma. We have to admit cause and effect seems to be reliant upon some level of something happening temporally previous to something else, the cause preceding the effect. And yet there are demonstrations, certainly in many that I'm aware of in some science, that explain or show sometimes when the effect seems to precede the cause. And it becomes very confusing in that regard. I don't want to go too far in that, though, in saying that, again, we are conditioned nonetheless by time. In the karma that we've created, the types of existences that we have, we still will be experiencing the effects of the actions that we've done in the past. And those will play out as long as we are under the control of those factors. The whole of Buddhist path, again, is to help us to either be free of that, to attain our liberation where we're no longer bound in that way, or to attain complete enlightenment where we can help others to be unbound from that whole process. So my conclusion I often come to is just to simply acknowledge that time is a part of the equation as long as we're in samsara, as long as we are conditioned in this way.
Mm-hmm.
When we transcend that, what it's like and what the experience is, I don't know. But
mm-hmm.
again, even within our world, when we do see these things observed that show that there's different dimensions to time and maybe not such a linear dimension to it, I still end up feeling like there's got to be some underwriting principle that's taking place here that is somewhat temporally bound. To create
mm-hmm.
the causes after the effect simply wouldn't make sense in terms of what karma is presenting.
Yeah, I mean, cause and effect is, I mean, that's the whole idea. I mean, you can't
yeah.
separate it from before and after.
Right. And the other side of it is that if you did potentially say that you could experience effects without causes, which is kind of what that's like, because
yeah.
the cause hasn't been created yet,
yeah.
well, then the state of freedom from all of that could never really happen because we still would have the potential to experience an effect without having created the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
it becomes a bit of a hard thing to reconcile.
Yeah.
Like I said, whenever those questions come, my mind sort of checks out, and I kind of listen to the question,
but
I go, I don't know that I can answer
okay.
such a complicated question.
I'm fine with checking out as long as you are, too.
Thanks for asking it, though, Kim. We get that out of the way on Friday night, so we don't have to work over the weekend. Yeah, Barry,
yeah,
a quick question.
It's not a political statement or anything, but just something that's stuck in my mind from the light of the path retreat.
Uh-huh.
Somebody asked Rinpoche what he thought about Donald Trump. And this is not anything
yeah.
about Donald Trump. This is about karma. So
yeah.
we'll just forget that. And he didn't make any statement what he thought about him. But what he said was, if he gets elected, that's the American people's karma.
Right.
And he said, there's going to be lots of suffering, could be
yeah.
wars, and the American people will see suffering like they have never seen before. And that was his statement. And that was something that stuck in my mind, and I don't know if it'll ever come true, but that's all related to karma. He
yeah.
said that.
Yeah, Lama Sopa Rinpoche was quite skillful in how he answered that question, because he essentially just said, you know, that we will get the president we have the karma for. And so we can't look at it as something, even if we may not have cast votes for that particular candidate, that isn't our karma. That is still our karma. You know, and we have to deal with the ramifications of that. Now, that having been said, as I said, it's a very dynamic process. Every one of us can still have a great influence on what
right.
this country does and on what happens by virtue of our own actions, by virtue of our own decisions. So, and it's vast. I mean, look at how many people live in this country, and then we even have influences from other countries and so on. So don't think that because of this we sort of just shrug our shoulders and stand back and say, you know, let's let the karma play out. We can we can make some conscious choices about what conditions we will put into place or not put into place that can have a very different bearing.
Sometimes I was thinking
yeah.
we'd get a little negative about karma because we always think of it as something negative, so like if natural
yeah.
disasters, but we all have the karma to be here tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so if we think about, like, do we have the karma for His Holiness to come? Remains to be seen, but we can be ready, we can make our mind ready.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
the collective karma, if a tornado hits, we also are collectively in that together too, right now.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
To think that we've met the teachings is a really cool way to think of karma. If you get down about it, sometimes it can get heavy. So
yeah.
to think where you got yourself, that, you know, that dawn arrived is a beautiful karma slice right here.
Thank you.
Amy,
it's
really
Amy.
Boring, though. I don't know.
If everybody's okay, we'll have one more comment from
Amy.
I
all know the answer because I'm sort of new at this. But,
So,
and you don't even have to answer it now, but just I was wondering if in the next few days you were going to talk about on your wheel here you have the right intention.
Sure.
It always seems to me that the right intention should be at the top. And because without the right intention, if you're not meditating for the right
mm-hmm.
intention,
right.
which is really no intention.
So the logic
it
behind
it seems
that.
Like it should be the
yeah.
leader of everything, because without that kind of leading everything else, it
mm-hmm.
doesn't seem. But you don't need to talk about that. I was wondering if you were going to talk about.
Yeah.
And I get that they all.
Yes.
That
they feed
they
into
all,
each other,
you know,
sure.
feed onto each other and so forth, yeah.
But in brief, what I can say, just to answer your question, is that in this presentation, the idea is that without some understanding, it'd be hard to generate the correct intention, you know, or the skillful intention, because we have to have an understanding of the concepts that we're looking at on this first section. to really get the motivation, the movement of the mind towards a particular goal, towards achieving something, whether it be, again, a more temporal goal or certainly these more long-lasting goals of liberation, enlightenment, and so on. So you all have some level of intention that already begins that process, sure. You know, to say, oh, I want to learn about the Buddha's teachings. I want to have some understanding. That's a preliminary intention that absolutely is essential to get you to even be curious about what's happening this weekend and so on, or what, you know, your first encounter with Buddhism, whenever that happened. But to really formulate it into something that becomes the driving force behind the whole path, it requires this level of understanding, is the way that, that's the logic for why it's set out that way. Okay? Good. Thank you all for being patient and staying for these questions. So when we resume tomorrow, and I guess we're starting at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, what I'll do is I'll continue with this exploring understanding, giving some context for the main teachings that inform the Buddhist path, and then we'll just go right through each of these, and again, we'll spend as much time as we need to, but I'm hoping we have enough time. This is a lot to fit into the time that we have, but it'll give us at least an overview of each of these. I'll make sure that we touch on at least all eight of them to some degree and give you a good idea of what's all involved in this presentation of how we practice the path. So let's do a couple of prayers that are called dedication prayers. Most of you know what this is. On page 235, I think, is probably the ones that you use. We're just going to do the first two here, and we're going to recite these in English. The idea behind dedication is that we're still working with our minds. We've been working with our minds for the last hour and a half, and now we're working with our minds with the idea that everything, all the seeds that we planted, everything positive that we put into our minds, we really want to nurture that and make sure that it stays somewhat secure, that it gives rise to the best result, the result of enlightenment for ourselves and all beings. And we also want to have that become a cause for this mind that we call bodhicitta, that is our intention to achieve that greatest goal of Buddhahood, that will continue to grow and develop in our own hearts and in the hearts of all beings. So let's recite these two prayers with those thoughts in mind. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. So since we're a little bit late, let's just have a few additional thoughts rather than any additional prayers. Let's dedicate also for the good health and long lives of our precious teachers, especially His Holiness the Dalai Lama, as well as our spiritual director, Kyabji Zopa Rinpoche, and all of our teachers, especially the Geshe's here, everyone else that we and others have a karmic connection with, so we will continue to benefit from these beings in our lives. And then finally, dedicate for anyone else that you're holding in your heart right now, whether these be beings that are having difficulties, obstacles, or maybe you know those that are sick or who are dying or who have died. Make strong prayers for their welfare, dedicating that they might be free from their suffering and achieve true peace and happiness. And may all beings achieve true happiness through our efforts here tonight. Okay, thank you all very much. Have a good, restful evening, and see you tomorrow.